turn my mic off. Just leave it on, George. This is not the Martha Dean Show, please. Just keep it on strong, man. Gotta have some way to talk to the people. All right, all set for a little Western drama out there. All set for a little drama of real life in America's storied, fabled, mythical West. With the hammer cocked that way? Of course! Boom! That's the way it happened at the Pima, Arizona Sheriff's Office last week. A reporter asked about the cocked hammer on Deputy A.L. Burns' new automatic pistol. Deputy Burns, wearing his 10-gallon hat, slapped the pistol grip to show him how safe it was. Boom! The gun fired, ripping through the deputy's back pocket, blowing his wallet all the way across the room. The bullet glanced off his badge and ripped his pants, and it's trailed to the floor, inches from the reporter's foot. No one was injured in the shootout in Tucson. Oh, my God almighty, where did everybody go? Thank you, George. Hey, let's hear that sound. Bring it up. Come on, this is a great sound right here. Wow!
Hey, loaded! I knew it wasn't loaded!
There it goes. Real great, George. Hey, listen, George, before you throw that away, before you put that aside here, after all, you know, it's Saturday, it's messing around time, and one great thing about Saturday, you know, the bosses are all gone, they're sitting on the fantails of their boats and all that stuff, you know, playing golf, doing all that stuff, you know, using all them credit cards and all that. We can sit around here and just do stuff. Hey, let me hear that again. That's a great sound. May I have that, please? Something about that piece, that opening scene there. Just cue it up there, George. And I'll give you the cue now. Just hold it there. I'll give you the cue when to start that, baby. You know, I think that the whole connotation of sound is just a the idea. Westerns, of course. I don't think there's a guy today who has not, in some way or another, been imbued with the Western. I mean, it's a fact. It's an absolute fact. From all angles, every conceivable type of Western, ranging all the way to the Italian Western. You ever seen any of those? They always keep reminding me of $3 bills, but a lot of people like $3 bills. So I'm not going to argue about that. But nevertheless, the whole concept of the Western has always, you just say Western to people, and instantly the whole, no matter how intellectual they are or how non-intellectual they are, a whole series of things, you know, go on in their mind. Now, I could say to you, operetta, nothing. I could say, you know, nothing. You say, oh, well. I could say to you, almost anything, drawing room comedy. Nothing. Oh, what? Drawing room. What's a drawing room? And what is a drawing room, by the way? I've never been in a drawing room my whole life, as far as I know. They keep using the phrase, you know, drawing room comedy. I've never been in a drawing room. But what do they do in a drawing room? What do they draw in the drawing room? You know, I never thought of that. It just all of a sudden hit me. What the hell is a drawing room, you know? But, we don't want to get too metaphysical here on a Saturday night. It goes again. Back trouble, George. Back trouble. But this whole thing of the Western. Now close your eyes for a second. We're going to try a little psychological listening participation in there. just to close your eyes, especially if you're driving along the Jersey Turnpike. That'd be really exciting. Just close your eyes, see? Turn up the radio and imagine your own Western. Purple hills. Now, do you imagine the kind of Western when out come the credits, over it, there's always either Frankie Lane or Tony Bennett singing the so-called theme music. Give me a little echo chamber, can you, George? Oh, there was
a stranger!
I'm sorry. You know, there was a stranger come to our little town. Who is that? I can't see through the glass. Duck down. I still can't see. Hi, how are you? You studio, you know, this is a special studio here, mate. This is the slum studio, WR, so you can't really see through the glass or anything like that, you know. May I, George, please? A little scary music now. If you think you've had rotten things happen to you in your house, I just thought I ought to bring a little note to you that I don't know what's happening. The whole world, you know, it's all going on all the time. A little scary music, please, George. Symbolically, this happened and is happening this minute in Pleasantville, New Jersey. Not Spooky Joint, New Jersey, or Bad Scene, New Jersey, but Pleasantville, New Jersey. The Invasion of the Toads. Sounds like something you'd see on a late night TV horror show. And that's exactly what it is. What a fantastic half-hour sequence this would make on the Twilight Zone for Mr. and Mrs. Fred Miller of Pleasantville, New Jersey. The toads have invaded. And right now, this minute, they are atop the TV set, in front of it, in the bathroom, all over the house. For the past 3 summers, the Miller's ranch-style home has been invaded by toads, but usually only one or two at a time. This year, they came. Ah. 73 big toads were caught in the Miller home one night alone last week. 73. During a recent investigation, there were about 35 toads in the living room alone. 10 in the kitchen, 20 in the den, and between 5 and 7 in the bathrooms and the bedrooms. And God knows how many were in the basement. Everybody's afraid to go down. Poor Miller. He said he has consulted with exterminators and agricultural officials, and nobody knows. No one can explain how the toads get in the house or where they come from. None of the houses in the neighborhood has the problem and has not even seen one toad. There are no swamps. There are no marshes nearby. The toads just keep coming. Man, you think cockroaches are bad. How would you... Yeah. Now, you know, a toad is not one of nature's more lovable creatures. At least it's never been to me. They don't do anything. But, you know, they're kind of rotten looking, you know. They sit there.
And there's a certain enigmatic quality about toads. Just certain. Can you imagine 35 toads in the living room alone? 35! One toad causes, fist fights when it shows up. somehow, maybe something is trying to say something to Mr. Miller. I don't put anything down, do you, George? I don't laugh at nothing. I don't laugh at magic, nothing anymore. Nothing, friend. I want to tell you, I used to, it's funny how I used to laugh at it. Come on, love potions, get out. Some night when I'm really loose, and, I figure, there's no sense in going on or something like that, when you don't give a damn what's going to happen. Let me tell you about the thing that happened to a friend of mine last year when on a gag down on 14th Street, he bought himself $5 worth of love potion. You want to hear that story? Oh, I ain't going to tell it to you yet. The world is not ready for it. In fact, I'm not ready for it yet. I know he wasn't. But it actually was an unbelievable scene that developed that, But the toads, I'll tell you about animals like that getting in the house. I mean, the strange things. Did I ever tell you about the time, this reminds me of a thing that happened to me one time playing the outfield. Now, outfielders are different from infielders, and at one time I was playing the outfield one whole year, and outfielders become nature lovers. Infielders, got a lot of things to worry about, like keeping their teeth all in one place, where they should be. Oh, boy, I'll never forget one time seeing a guy get, he pulled the ball, down the third baseline, fantastic shot, and the third baseman's mind, I don't know where it was someplace, but he made the mistake of trying to feel the ball with his mouth open. And all I remember for that minute, there was a shower of teeth. It was like a fine spray of teeth. You could just see him in the air. By the way, the guy was given a hit. He got a double on it. And for the next 20 minutes, people were out there on their hands and knees going around picking up teeth. Now, they weren't false. There was real teeth. They were afraid somebody would slide in there, there'd be problems. But nevertheless, when you're an outfielder, you start enjoying nature. You walk around. For example, did I tell you about the rare weed I discovered? This is the truth, everybody, there's a whole, the whole drug-oriented generation is constantly experimenting, looking for something that they can, turn on with, anything. Well, I'm standing out in the outfield one day, and you probably watch. If you ever watch a ball game on television, they show you an outfielder. You see this guy out there up against the fence. He's standing out there. Well, what do you think's going through his mind, in between long moments when the pitcher's walking around and they're getting the sign or they're kicking the dirt or they're having a conference at the mound? What do you think he's doing? Well, hard to say really what he's doing because he couldn't really tell you himself. His mind is sort of in its own way, out in its own left field. And just sort of stare because you feel remote from the ball game in the outfield in a curious way. You do, you sort of mess around out there. And the outfielders tend to begin to examine grass a great deal. Because you see a lot of grass. Your office is grass, as a matter of fact. And so you examine it a lot. And you begin to do things with it. For example, watch the average outfielder someday, and you'll notice that he seems to bend over a great deal, and like he's picking things up or plucking at things. Well, what is he doing? Well, most outfielders tend to chew on grass after a while. They do. I have never known an outfielder that didn't eat a lot of grass during the season. Now, I don't know what this does to a guy biologically. After a while, he turns into a ruminant or whatever it is. What do they call a cud-chewing animal? A ruminant? Something like that? So you become a cud-chewer out there. And so you mess around. You kick dirt and you look around. You pick up this weed and that weed. And you put anything in your mouth. You wind up putting pebbles in your mouth. And there was a weed I discovered in this one outfield. We used to play in different parks all the time. We travel around. And it was one outfield had pepper in it. It had some kind of a wild pepper that was growing, a little low weed-like, a little tiny thing that would grow in between the real grass, a little weed, and had little round, bright green leaves, very bright green, almost like, lime green, bright green. And attached to the leaves, or right below the leaves, there were little tiny pods. Little tiny things about the size of the head of a pin. Well, I would see these things, you see, and I look forward to coming to that park. Because I'm messing around out there hour after hour. An outfielder's life, friends, is very much the way they describe the life of a pilot. Hours and hours of boredom and brief seconds of sheer terror. This is exactly what happens to an outfielder because, you know, you mess around, all of a sudden, when your mind is... Have you ever wondered why, they'll say, Lindsey Nelson will be out, he says, there's a windup and a pitch, and then you hear this, he says, Tommy Agee, oh, he misjudged it, he's, oh, there he goes, he's got it, what a catch! For a minute there, he was going... Well, what happened was that Agee's mind was, you know, drifting around out there, and all of a sudden you hear this whack! And for a brief second, you don't know where the ball's going. You think, you know, what, is it a pop-up? What, you know? And then you hear this, wah, the crowd, you know it's coming, you know? And you sense it, and you got to go somewhere. You don't just stand, see? So he makes a lunge to his left, and then the last instant, he sees it going to his right. That's when he, in midair, he changes direction and makes this diving, rolling catch. Theoretically. A diving, rolling thing at it. Now, he didn't lose it in the sun. He lost it in the left field of his mind, which is where you lose balls, generally. And you can't come back and say, well, I was thinking of my bowling game, you know. You can't come back to, you know, when the manager, and he said, what happened there? You can't say, well, you know, I just dozing off and, oh, no. You have to say, hey, look, if you have... Go out there. Take a look. Look at the window reflection up the light tower. For crying out loud, I can't even see the damn batter. Much as, you know, you go on and on like this. Say, give me my glasses. Give me quick the sunglasses. Well, that's nothing. That's window dressing. What happens? Your mind goes off. See, so I'm standing out there, and I start to experiment with the grass, and I'm chewing, and I'm, boy. This grass had a sharp, poignant flavor to it. It tasted almost like fresh pepper. You know how fresh pepper, you got a piece of fresh ground pepper and you crunch it in your teeth and you get that sharp kind of tingly sense on the tongue. Well, I'm out there from about the first time it actually happened to me. It's a strange moment. I'm out there and I began to mess around chewing the grass. Well, I get this thing on the tongue and it was interesting, see, so... Between innings, I take a glass of water. They have a water cooler thing. I drink a little cold water. Whee! It comes back again. See, there's this thing with the tongue. So the next inning, I'm back out in the outfield again. I mess around with the stuff again. Well, the first time, I was only out there for two innings after my discovery, and I never thought anything about it. So a couple of weeks go by. We're at other ballparks. And by the way, my favorite grass for regular day-in and day-out non-turning-on chewing was, if you're curious, clover. Clover's great to chew on. I'm talking about the kind, you know, with the little clover flowers and all. It's really terrific. I have to chew the stems. The stems are really good. You could kind of like them, you know. I'm chewing stems. And I even got so I used to like, I really did like dandelion leaves. You know, have you ever had dandelion wine? Groovy. It's good. Have you ever had dandelion salad? You ever had that? Well, dandelions, you know, you can make a whole salad out of dandelions. So I'm out there eating dandelions, and you know, my usual routine, grass, dandelions. And if I'm working on a field where they don't have dandelions or clover, I would settle for ordinary grass. You know, and I'd even settle for, crabgrass, if I had to, see, which is not too good. I mean, crabgrass has got a certain acrid charm, but it's rather common. It doesn't have the, you know, the panache of a real vintage weed. So... a couple of weeks go by, and now I'm going... The whole game, see, I'm out in right field. By the way, right field among outfielders is generally considered one of the worst fields to play. It's a hard field to play for a number of reasons. For one of the most important reasons is that a lot of shots you get out in right field are unpredictable because they're off the end of the bat. There are a great preponderance of ball players, you know, are right-handed, like in life, you see. So what happens when a right-handed hitter hits a shot to right field? Well, that means he's gotten off a shot which is off the end of the bat and spinning. You see, he's reached out. The ball has been a little faster than he thought it was. It's almost past him. He catches it. He gets a slice, you know. And that thing comes sailing out in the right field, and you don't know where it's going to go. If you're in left field, however, and you get a shot from a right-handed hitter, it's a straightaway shot. You know, he's hitting it straightaway and pulling it. So these are all technical details, which I'm sure mean nothing to you crochet fans. However, I'm standing right out the outfield. This will interest you. Give me a little of that scary music. You can reset that up there, George. We'll need that. I'm standing around out in the outfield, and it was a particularly non-outfield game. You know, some days an outfielder can go through a whole game and never even feel the ball. Never comes to him at all. And when the pitcher's really on, see. So we had this guy who was a terrific, really fine left-handed pitcher. And nobody was hitting that ball to left field. He was to right field. He was really laying it in. So I'm just out there, you know, taking it easy. And it's warm. It's a beautiful day. So immediately Shepard plunges into the grass. So I start eating the grass. And it's that field where all these great little pods are, see. So I'm chewing away in the pods. And I'm looking for them now. Before it was hit or miss, see. So I'm looking for the pods because I like that little sharp kind of a cinnamony taste. It's like a curious cinnamon quality from chewing a really good flavor. See, zap, you know. Ooh, boy, I can feel this. My tongue is tingling. So I look for more. I look for more. Whole inning goes by. I must have had maybe a half pound of these weeds. So now I go back into the dugout, and I'm going to be up to bat, see. So I go back into the dugout. I was batting third. I go back into the dugout, and I sit down. And the first batter gets up, and he's taking his cuts. You know, we're playing away there. The second batter gets up, and he pops up or something, and I got to take a glass of water again. Rod had that sharp thing. So I'm up at bat, and I go through the whole inning. Next inning, okay, Shepard is out in the outfield. About halfway through the second inning, eating these weeds, I pick up a sprig of weeds, and I'm chewing away at it. Ball game's going on somewhere out there in the middle distance. I pick up another one. I'm spitting. You know how I feel as you walk around spitting. You know. Take your glove. You know. You got to go through the motion like you're with it, see? So I'm chewing more weeds. All of a sudden, curious. I get the hottest sensation. I get the feeling as though the outfield was drifting away from me. I mean, like, you know, the ground was just going off from under me, but drifting away so nice. You know, like as if somebody had, if somebody could hit a ball like, you know, 30 feet over my head, it would have been waist high.
Nah.
Like, you know, 400 feet high, Shepard is all of a sudden. Chewing away in a weed. Kevin, what, you know, what's going on here? I just drifted around. It lasted maybe, oh, I don't know really, maybe 10, 15 seconds. Come on. Strange. I thought, what the hell? And I did not relate it to the weed, remember. At that point, I didn't relate it at all to this weed. Well, then some action began in the ball game. Somebody hit a shot out to left field, and I had to run over, you know, cover the throw and a little bit because the guy's trying to make the throw to first. I go back, you know, I cut in back of the first baseman to cut. So I got some action. I'm running around. I've been sweating. The next inning, I forgot all about the weeds, and it was the last out. The next inning, Shepard is back out in the outfield again, and the pitcher's pitching real good. He's laying it in there, and I'm messing around. I pick up a couple of weeds, and I start chewing like I always did. It was my habit always to chew, and I'm chewing on these little pods. When that strange feeling we get. What the hell? I was watching. I was looking at the second baseman. It was a strange moment. I'm watching the second baseman, and I had the distinct impression. I remember the vision I got of it, that there were three second basemen who were kind of in a row, and the middle one was the biggest one, see? What's happening? What's going on? And somebody hit a pop-up. It was eerie. The pop-up seemed to hang in the air for 15, 20 minutes. I never saw a pop-up do that. It was like it was a balloon. Hanging in midair. And I see seven shortstops going after it. Going after it like the Rockettes. I'm not kidding. And then it faded out. Just faded out. And it was at that point that I decided I better lay off them weeds. I better lay off them weeds. Because there was something real sneaky and real dangerous out there, and I didn't know quite what it was. Which reminds me, this is WOR in big old friendly New York.
South of the equator, the trade winds are soft and warm. Come along with Buckus to Fiji's legendary ports of paradise, to New Zealand with its geysers and glaciers, to Australia. Fly Qantas. Fly Qantas on a tour that treats you better all around. From California, only $995 for 17 South Pacific days. And just about everything. The South Pacific. It's all out there, waiting. See your travel agent and fly Qantas.
Fly Qantas. Qantas treats you better all around. Treats you better all around. All aboard and we will soar. Around the Pacific Shore. Qantas treats you better all around.
Gee, it's nice. Isn't that a nice sound? That's a beautiful sound, I'll tell you. Hey, listen, speaking of beautiful sounds, now listen here. I'm going to add, this is a direct order. Direct order, all set? This is that time of year, according to 522 letters I've received in the last week. This is the time of the year for the Playboy jazz and pop music poll, right? All right. The guy writes me and he says, Shepard, I am for the third consecutive year, I am voting for you as the top miscellaneous instrument player. I'm voting for you as the best used harp player in the business. All right. I agree with his selection. Well, I do. Damn it. And so I am going to insist that all my... You know, my ardent fans who love the sound of my dulcet jew's harp, get on the shtick right now, this minute, and send in your vote to the Playboy Jazz and Pop poll listing Shepard under Miscellaneous Instruments, parentheses, jew's harp. I demand it. That's it. Now, well, you know, politicians all demand that you vote for them. I mean, if you're going to vote for good, who do they say you should vote for? Them, right? I never heard a politician say, listen, I want to get elected because, you know, I dig the idea of getting on the Gabe Pressman show and I would love to, you know, get on TV and be interviewed by David Susskind, and I really want to get elected because, you know, they give you a limousine, you ride around and you can park your car anywhere. I kind of vote for a politician. You know, the guy that's running, he says, I'd like to have one of those badges on the front of my car. You know, it's a state legislature. Oh, man. But would you please, I'm not kidding, I am insisting, vote for Shepard for miscellaneous instrument, jew's harp. I will now give you a demonstration why you should vote for me.
You like that, George? You really dig that, don't you? You know, every time I get George on, he's working with me, I'm always inspired to play this thing. George, I'll tell you, there's another good kind on that. Let me see. That was the Sheik. Listen, would you get the other one? Yeah, hold it up there. That's a terrific, the Sons of the Whiskey Rebellion. Dig it out there. Yeah, there you go. I'll show you a good one. Give me the first cut. Coney Island. Cut one. Cut one, side one. You want to hear some real sounds on this little bippy here. Now, I'm doing this now. I understand, of course, I will get 422 letters from nice, shaky, purple-inked ladies. You know, oh, dear Mr. Shepherd, I can't stand that awful sound you make. Please tell more about your mother and your trip to India. Now, oh, my God almighty, where will it stop? All right, boy, hit it. Here we go. There we go, man. You know, George, I want to show you something. You may be interested. This one right here, as a matter of fact, is the one. I carried this through all the time I was in the Army. I had this thing with me. And I can tell you, it certainly won me friends. Yeah. I don't know. There's something about the Jews hat. People either hate it or love it. It's just like, what's that? Three. Three what? You want to hear these? You want to hear the other three? How many do I have? Let's see. Right now, I am the proud owner of five truly elegant Jew's harps. No, these are all good ones. These are not, you know, the kind... I think people tend to, confuse them with those little toys you buy at the dime store. These are not. And these are all different types. For example, look at this one, George. This Jew's harp here is roughly 75 years old. This one was made in the 1880s, late 80s. And very interesting Jew's harp. It was sent to me by the person who said that it was owned by her grandfather. And they had this in his effects and so on. She says, I thought you'd like to have it. It's a great one. And look at that. Look at how elegant it is. A really great looking. You want to hear what a 75-year-old Jew's harp sounds? This is a real piece of Americana. It's got a... Now, that sound is a little more like a dulcimer. really, than the other one. This is a modern, excellent jew's harp, one of the most difficult to buy today. Here it's got a more of a heavy, deep sound. And this one is a classical. Incidentally, it has a hand hammered and tempered tongue in it. You can see where it's actually been hammered. This is a handmade juice. Of course, those are the others. In fact, all these are. But this one here is particularly interesting. Now, I'll give you an idea how the difference in sound is. George, would you please give me a Hindustan on that same cut there, that same record. And I'll give you an idea how the different ones sound. And just give me the opening phrases, George, and when I cue you to stop, then reset it, and I'll show you how the different jew's harps sound. Now, I have with me tonight, I have my usual collection here. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of my jew's harps, and they're from, they're from 4 different countries. Here's an Austrian jew's harp. This is an interesting one. You can do some very subtle things with this Austrian one. Listen to this. So you can get some wide variety of sounds with this one. Now I'll play this Austrian jew's harp and give you an idea of what you can do with it. Okay, George. The Austrian jew's harp has a peculiar plangent sound. In fact, it sounds a little bit like. Do you remember the zither music for The Third Man? They go for sounds like that over there. In fact, very few people play the zither in America. It's not a sound, and even though it is a folk instrument and has been played by folk instrumentalists for centuries in America, it has never become a popular instrument. That is, you don't hear the zither played in cafes. You don't hear a great zither player playing down here at the Bitter End or anything like that, because the zither has just never in America. This isn't a sound that Americans like. You know, it's funny when you think about sounds as being a national characteristic, like a national taste. Has it ever occurred to you that food, for example, hello, what's that home there? Food, for example, has a, we all recognize the fact that different nationalities will have a different national taste in food. For example, if you go to, Mexico, for example, they have a taste for much hotter food, much more spicy food than, let's say, the average taste is in America. On the other hand, you'll go to other countries, like, say, England, for example, and you'll find their food, compared to ours, is quite tasteless. They don't have, now that doesn't mean it isn't good. For an Englishman, it is. They don't have a taste for spices at all. They just don't like spicy food. And so you go to England, a lot of vegetables will be boiled, meat will be boiled, a great deal of it. And they go for blander food. So we recognize this in food. But we don't really, I've never heard anybody talk about the fact that sounds are also a national taste. So if you go to, say, a country like Poland, for example, I've been in Poland, and you know what you hear a great deal of in Poland, which you hardly ever hear here? That's concertinas and accordions. They love accordions. You go, every Polish, in fact, right now, I'm sure there's a lot of Polish people listening. And every Polish dance you go to, there's somebody playing an accordion. I mean, it's a big thing. Well, now, we recognize the fact that in Spain, for example, Spain has a great predilection to guitars. They like the sound of a guitar. And even the classical music, somebody will write a symphony, you'll find a guitar is in the middle of it somewhere. This is a great taste in their country. Our country, no. Guitar is popular for certain things, but it is rarely considered a classical instrument. We tend to believe a classical instrument is a piano or a violin. And some countries rarely see violins. You rarely see a violin played in many countries. On the other hand, you go to India now, for example, and you rarely see a piano. It's just not a national taste. They don't have a taste for that particular sound. And the jew's harp is like that. Now, a lot of you people sitting out there, this is not a pleasant sound to you. I will concede that. Because your ear is tuned to other more American and more, I suppose you can say, more conventional sounds in our times. Now, you know, many people will believe that the thing that they like, now this is where intolerance comes in. Many people believe that the thing they like is the thing that if other people were intelligent, would like too. In short, a lot of people will believe that the kind of food they like is the ultimate kind of food. Whatever they like is what real people eat. Now, all the others are faking it or whatever it might be. And that holds true for music, too, that you'll find, for example, a guy who may be a total rock cuckoo. He believes that his form, that music, is the ultimate. That's where it is. And they even mean it, that when you say that's where it is, that means that anybody who likes anything else is obviously not with it. He's just not there. Well, you find this true among jazz fans. You find it true among classical people who dig classics. You even find it true among the Lawrence Welk people who will say to you, what is all this noise? To them, what is real music is Florence Zimmer or Norma Zimmer singing Beautiful Ohio, accompanied by three guys on accordions. Well, all right, I'm not putting it down. I'm saying this is the way it is. Taste is very subjective. And also, taste, we tend to defend it. Now, the jew's harp is an instrument that has had great periods in history, great periods of classical acceptance. Now, I don't know how I got on the subject tonight, but I might as well do it just since I'm on it. During the 18th and early 19th century, there were several very famous French jew's harpists who literally took the concert halls by storm. There is music, in fact, in the classical repertoire that was written for jew's harp. In fact, right now in a museum, I believe it is the British Museum. I'm not sure of this fact. One of the great displays there is a jew's harp that was played by a virtuoso who played and designed his own. I believe it was in the late 18th and early 19th century. He had a jew's harp, a tremendous jew's harp that had 17 different tongues. He covered tremendous range with it, very difficult to play. In fact, nobody else would be able to play it. But this guy had music written for him. He traveled all over the concert hall of Europe and was, considered a fantastic musician, and he was. Now, in certain countries, this sound, for example, the sound of the zither, you remember, you remember the third man theme, now that is a characteristic sound. That plangent sound of the zither is very similar to the sound of a jew's harp. So in Austria, the jew's harp is a very popular instrument, serious instrument, not just kids. We tend to think of it as kids over here. It's a hard instrument to play. I've never heard a kid play the jew's harp well, any more than you will hear a kid play a classical guitar well. It just takes too long to learn it. It's a hard instrument to play. Now, these are fine Austrian jew's harps. I have two of them with two different ranges. Here's another one. I'll give you the next one. Here the two. Now, here's an English jew's harp with the same sound. That's a nice sound. And here's another. This is a German jew's harp. It's got a, listen to it.
Oh,
How do you like that sound? Or you like the second one? Is this the one you like? All right, everybody, most people like this sound, and I'll tell you why they like this sound, because this sound is really closer to the kind of ear that we have. This is the English one, and it's a little closer to the type of ear that we're used to. Now, this sound, I'll give you, again, I'll go back to the Austrian Jews harp. Now, that sound has a great overtone of that zither sound. This doesn't really. It's more of a mellow, less plangent quality. A plangent is that Now, of course, that's all a matter of taste. Now, I will play, let's see, give me that thing again. Now, I played the Austrian harp with it. Now I'll play the English harp with that same tune. You'll hear what that sounds like with it. Got only a couple of minutes here, but before we, I'm going to show you something about the Jews' harp. Now, you're used to hearing it played with as a part of a group. Now, the Jews' harp, by the way, is very, very popular in Sicily. It is a genuine. I don't want to use the term folk music, because after all music is folk, really. All music that you hear in the world comes out of human beings. And that's such a strange word, folk. But the Sicilian Jews harpists are phenomenal. Now, the sound that I'll show you how a Jews harp is played as a solo instrument now, as opposed to an instrumental instrument where you're part of an instrumental group. There's a great deal of tongue action and head action in it. Here, for example, is what I mean. Complicated. And you can get different sounds by the control of your breath. For example, here's a straight sound. Listen to this. It's a different breath control. So it's quite an instrument, and I feel this personally. I feel that within the next 5 years, with the increasing, I think people are getting more sophisticated in general and more receptive to sound. Just as food is changing today, you can buy food, you can go to the frozen food counter and get Danish vegetables, for example. Yeah, you can, you know. You can go into the frozen food counter today and you can get yourself anything from enchiladas to Indian food. You really can. Well, a few years ago, you couldn't have done that. And I think people are beginning to, appreciate other things, which is all of the good as far as I'm concerned. And I think that in a few years, you're going to find more and more people are going to start hearing these sounds. And I would say within 3 or 4 years, the Jews harp is going to be a big deal. And you will forget that you heard about it here. You will start writing me and asking me what I think of X, who is playing the Jews harp. Well, that's the way it always is. However, I'd love to cut an LP. A really good LP with original music written for Jews harp. I'm talking about notated, good, solid, orchestrated music, because it's a spectacularly interesting instrument, properly played, and incidentally properly listened to. I remember 5 years ago, I was playing sitar music on my shows. 7, 8 years ago, and I get thousands of letters. What is this jangling junk you're playing? From the same people, by the way, who stood in line
at Carnegie Hall when it became the right time for it. That's important, the right time. And Ravi Shankar was playing it for all those years. Who cared, you know? It was just jangling sounds. So, you know, try to think an honest thought over the weekend. Keep your gut pulled in and give them a low, low silhouette. Here's a...